Glory.
Glory to thee, O God, glory to thee, O heavenly King, comforter, the spirit of truth, who art everywhere present and fillest all things, treasury of good things and giver of life, come and abide in us, cleanse us from every stain, and save our souls, O good one, O Lord, bless. All right, welcome to lecture number 13. 13, this is the one that I've been really looking forward to. 13 and 14 are going to be the culmination of everything we've talked about so far. So last week, we spoke about how we approach church history, including some pointers on what to look for and what to look out for. We also talked about the ecumenical councils, what prompted them, what they taught about Christ, who the heroes of the councils were, how the holiness of the fathers present are what make them reliable, because Christ reveals himself to people, and how the ecumenical synods did not decide what the church believed, as many scholars incorrectly believe, but rather the council simply expressed in words for the first time what the church had always believed. And the reason for this is so that people can guard themselves against heresy. That's the whole reason for the ecumenical synods, is you firmly set up these boundaries and say, if you're outside of these boundaries, you're outside of the proper doctrine. If you're outside of the proper doctrine, you're outside of proper truth. And if you're outside of proper truth, you don't have the full available healing that the church provides. And in some cases, you can actually harm yourself. You can be very harmed by heresy. And so we need to avoid that as much as possible. Finally, we began our three-part series, of which today we'll do part two, on some major saints of the church. So last week we discussed some of the most major theologians of the church, the ones who really have defined in words the theology of the church. We talked about Saints Athanasius of Alexandria, John Chrysostom, Gregory the Theologian, Basil the Great, and Gregory of Nyssa. There were a couple others that I wanted to get to. We didn't get to them, and we just won't get to them because we have other ones to discuss. But I was going to discuss Saint Cyril of Alexandria and Saint Maximus the Confessor, maybe even Saint John of Damascus, but we can only do so much. The same thing with today. Today we're going to continue, and we'll talk about some of the great spiritual guides of the faith. And we have probably seven to get through. Today, I was going to do eight. I just didn't have time to finish the eighth. And I left a lot out. It was a tough list to create because I had a list that was much longer than eight. And I had to decide which ones to actually talk about. So what I did is I chose the ones that I think are names that are going to come up the most often. I want you just to be familiar with the names. Obviously, you know, there's no test. You're not going to be tested on their lives and know all the details and everything they wrote. But you should have some familiarity with these names. Some you will have heard of, some you may not have heard of, but you'll hear about them in Orthodoxy. You'll hear throughout the church year, you'll hear these names, and you should know at least what their influence is. In some cases, some of their writings are very, very significant, and so we'll talk about those as well. So we're going to jump right into it, because again, we have a lot to cover, and I'm hoping that you understand why I look forward to this so much. Everything we've now had 11 different talks. No, I'm sorry, 12 different talks, all of which culminate. Remember, what was the running theme throughout everything we talked about? Relationship, right? Relationship with Christ. That was the idea behind everything. And so the question becomes, if this really works, then we ought to see the results. And in the results, we ought to see something really significant. What we ought to see are people who live and teach and act and think and pray and breathe like the apostles did. We know that that's the result of a real lived faith because we see it in the book of Acts. And if that's a life that's really available to us, we ought to see it repeated in church history again and again and again. And so if you want to know if a program of any sort is worth its salt, look to the results. You know, you've heard me say this in these very talks. If you look at a university and everyone who graduates from there is jobless, a jobless bum who lives with their parents, probably not that great of a university. But if you have a university where great scholars and innovators and you know, titans of business come out of there, you go, wow, this university knows what it's doing. It's the same with a church. So if the Orthodox Church says, this is the Church of the Apostles, your question should be, then show us the modern day apostles. Show us the apostles of today. Now we're going to talk about the apostles of today next week. That's going to be the modern saints. Right now we're going to talk about a lot of these saints who have served by their lives and writings as great spiritual guides throughout the centuries, who we still read today. Okay, so we're going to start off with a name I'm sure you've heard, St. Anthony. St. Anthony the Great. And I know you've heard it because you listened to last week's talk and you heard about his life a little bit in whose life? St. Athanasius, or Athanasius, as the Western pronunciation. So St. Anthony. St. Anthony was born in 251 in Egypt to pious Christian parents. At the age of 18 or 20, we're not really sure which age it was, but both his parents died at that age. And so about 6 months later, he was reflecting on the fact that the early Christians sold all of their possessions and gave their proceeds to the apostles. And as he's contemplating this, he passes by a church and he hears a gospel being read. And the gospel verse that he hears is, "If you would be perfect, go and sell all that you have and give it to the poor, and come, follow me, and you shall have treasures in heaven." And he takes this as a direct call from God. These words really speak to his heart, and they wake him up. And he says, "I want to be perfect, so I'm going to follow this precept." So he gives the care of his sister. He has a younger sister. He gives the care over to a convent. There's a community of virgins living in the city. He gives the care of his sister over to them. He takes all of his possessions and sells all of them. And what he doesn't give for the care of his sister, he gives away to the poor. And then he goes to the outskirts of the city to a little hut, and he survives on the alms of people. People go and give him alms, and he lives his days in prayers. This was a common thing at that time, where these ascetics would live on the outskirts of cities in these huts. And so he just joined what was already available to him. And what he would do is he would visit the various ascetics who lived around him, and he'd learn from them, and he'd find out which virtue has each ascetic really perfected. And when he found that they'd perfected a particular virtue or conquered a passion, he would say, "I want to imitate them." So he'd sit there and learn from them and ask them questions, and then he'd implement what he learned into his own life until he had conquered the same passion or mastered the same virtue. And then he'd go to the next ascetic and he'd learn from them. And so he's very active and very practical about the spiritual life. Terrible temptations attacked him. Temptations of doubt, temptations of returning to the world, and especially temptations of lust. He has one of his famous sayings is that, "When you flee out into the desert to fight the demons, avarice will depart from you because you don't own anything. And gluttony will leave you because you have nothing to eat. But one passion will remain, and that's lust. No matter what, you're going to have to fight that somehow, some way." Eventually, an angel appeared to him because he started to wonder, "What exactly should I do? I mean, how should I live out my days? I don't want to live just on the alms of others. I want to earn my keep." This is what St. Paul says. If you don't work, you don't eat. But I also know that when I work, I lose my sense of prayer. And so what am I going to do? And an angel appears to him. And the angel would stand up and pray for a while, and then sit and work for a while, and then stand up and pray for a while, and then sit and work for a while. And he heard this voice that said, "Do the same and you shall be saved." And so this is where he learned to alternate in his days work, which he would weave baskets, and then prayer, work in prayer, work in prayer, work in prayer, and try to keep the prayer as much as possible while he worked. He would only eat after sunset. He began sleeping only on every third day. This is a great ascetic feat. I mean, this is a difficult, the Russians call it a podvig, an ascetic practice. He would spend entire nights in prayer when he could. So then he decides that he wants to go deeper into the desert. And so he finds the cemetery further out in the desert, and he locks himself in a tomb. Now, this is where he begins to separate himself from these ascetics who were living in the outskirts of the city. It wasn't normal to go further out. But he thought, you know what, I need to get further out and go further into the desert. So he finds this far-off cemetery, and he locks himself in a tomb. And he has a friend who brings him provisions just every few days. Every few days he brings him a little bread, a little water, and that's what he lives off of. The demons began to realize that giving him suggestions to sin and suggestions to leave his ascetic life and go back to the world weren't working. And so there's an Athenite saying that first the demons bring suggestion, and when that no longer works, they bring the knife. And what that means is they'll begin to appear to you and actually attack you. This is what happens to many of the great saints. It happened to St. Paisios and many St. Joseph the Hesychast. Well, it happened to St. Anthony. The demons began to appear to him and physically beat him. And so one day, his friend finds him completely beaten, bloodied, and near death. In fact, he has to check it. Like, is he living? And he breaks into the tomb, And he has to carry him all the way to his home to recover. And St. Anthony is in a terrible condition here. But when he wakes and has a little bit of strength, he rolls off of the bed and crawls his way back to the tomb to continue fighting. He had an iron will. So he uses his little strength to crawl himself back to the tomb. And this time the demons take the form of wild beasts. But at the last minute, before they can just beat him to death, this light opens up at the top of the tomb and he sees Christ appear. And Christ drives all the demons away. And St. Anthony, he asks Christ, he says, "Where were you? Where were you as I was being beaten?" And Christ says, "Anthony, I was here, but I wanted to see your struggle. Now, since you have not yielded, I shall always help you and make your name known throughout all the world." By the way, I want to show you each time I talk about a saint their icon. And this is a really nice, I just found this. I haven't seen this one before of St. Anthony. It's a beautiful icon of St. Anthony. But one of my favorite icons of him, let me see if I can find it really quick, is this exact scene. You can get it from Uncut Mountain Supply. I like to have it in my prayer corner because, here it is, because every time I think I'm too tired to pray, I look at this icon and I go, "You're not that tired, idiot. you can struggle a little bit better than this." And this is that icon. You see all these wild beasts, and you can see them kind of a demonic form, and they're all surrounding Anthony. But you also see at the top, there's this light. There's this light coming down and being poured upon St. Anthony. So it's a pretty awesome icon. Okay. So God has now promised his name will be known throughout all the world. Soon after this, at the age of just 35, St. Anthony decides to do a completely unknown practice. He was a little bit outside the city limits. Now he's going to go deep into the desert. So he goes deep into the desert. He's the first one to do this, which is why he's known as the father of monasticism, even though people were living as monastics before him. He's the first one to really do this. And he finds this really run-down fort by a river, and he locks himself inside. And now his friend brings him bread just twice a year. Only twice a year does he bring him bread. He's eaten so little. He lived in seclusion for 20 years, completely locked up in this fort. People would come up to him and they'd want to get this glimpse of him through his little window, and they'd walk up. I told you about this already, I think. They'd hear the clanging of swords and shields, and they'd think, "My goodness, he's in this great battle." And they'd peek into this little window, and what did they see? He was just standing there in prayer. But spiritual warfare was occurring. He lived in seclusion for these 20 years, battling the demons and passions until he had obtained perfect dispassion and peace. Dispassion meaning no movements of his heart. He just had utter stillness and purity and love and peace in his heart at all times. When he finally opened his door, the people were shocked to see him. His life says that he had neither grown fat or strong from all the prostrations, nor fat from essentially not going out and working, nor was he completely emaciated from all the fasting. He looked the same. He looked the same. A lot of times you'll see in these ascetics that even though their bodies will look worn down, their faces always look young and bright. It's kind of an incredible thing. I think that was true of like Yodanus and Markel, right? Like it's hard to tell what her age is. You know, there's this youthfulness no matter what. So people began to discover him, and monastic communities began being built around him. So people would go and they started building their own huts because they just wanted to be near him and get some guidance from him. And so he started to guide all who came to him. He could heal the sick. He could cast out demons. He was clairvoyant. People didn't have to tell him what their issues were. He would just know, and he'd give them the proper advice, divinely inspired advice. He went back into the world only twice. Two times he traveled back into the world. The first time was during a period of persecution. And he thought, "Well, I want to be martyred too." And so he goes back into the world, but God preserves him. He's not martyred. So what does he spend his time doing? He visits those who are imprisoned for their faith, and he serves them. And when he sees that any of them are struggling with doubts or with concerns about the fact that they're going to die for their faith, he'd strengthen them. And they were very, very cared for by him. The second time he went into the city, it's because St. Athanasius probably had reported to him just how much the Arians were taking ground, and so he went to fight the heresies and to convince people. What was shocking was some of the heretics, especially the Arians, were very, very well educated. They knew philosophy, they knew logic and arguments very well, and they knew that St. Anthony was uneducated and probably unlettered. He probably didn't know how to read at all. We have some of his letters. They're probably dictated. And yet, he would defeat every one of them. He would spar with them in public, and they were put to shame by his arguments because he was divinely inspired. He reposed peacefully in 356 at the age of 105. His most famous disciple, you know, is St. Athanasius, to whom he left his monastic mantle and who wrote his life, including a very long ascetic section which contains St. Anthony's teachings on battling the demons. This is a book that is mentioned in St. Augustine's Confessions. St. Augustine mentions that a couple of the friends who he had seen this book and they read it. And when they read it, they were so overcome with zeal that they ran out of the deserts themselves to become monastics, which many people did. I mean, thousands upon thousands of people read this life and went, like, we got to do the same thing. The book was copied into many, many different languages. It was translated and it was spread all over the world very quickly. St. John Chrysostom believed that this was a book that every single Christian in the world should read. Every Christian should read this book at some point. So St. Athanasius' Life of St. Anthony. We have it I think at least one version. There's Early Christian Lives, a book back there, and that contains his life, but there's other versions of it. You can find it. It's very easily available today. I'll tell you just a modern thing about St. Anthony is that many people in America have seen him because they go down to Arizona where St. Anthony's monastery is, and he's been seen walking in the deserts around the monastery quite a few times. This is not uncommon. St. Anthony really, you know, has a great love for that monastery, apparently. A couple of teachings from St. Anthony. You can read it in the Sayings of the Desert Fathers. You'll see some of his sayings. So here's a few of them that I thought were really interesting. I mentioned this one last week. Abba Anthony said, "I saw all the snares of the enemy spread over all the earth. And sighing, I said, what could get through these? Then I heard a voice saying to me, humility. Humility is what overcomes all the traps of the demons. When the same Abba Anthony considered the depth of God's judgments, he asked, Lord, how is it that some die after a short life while others live on to ripe old age? And why are some people poor and others rich? And why do the unjust become wealthy, whereas the righteous are poor? And he heard a voice saying, Anthony, pay attention to just yourself. These things are the judgments of God, and it is not in your interest to learn about them. That was when I first read that, I found that very unsatisfying as the answer. And then over time, I found it more and more satisfying. Let God's providence take care of everything. He sees with eyes that we don't see with. Here's another one. He said also, life and death is from our neighbor. It's kind of a shocking thing when this guy lives with a hermit for so long. Life and death is from our neighbor. If we gain our brother, we gain God. But if we scandalize our brother, we have sinned against Christ. Abba Anthony said, a time is, this is one of my favorite ones because it's so relevant to today. You hear me quote this all the time. Abba Anthony said, a time is coming when men will go mad. And when they see someone who is not mad, they will attack him saying, you are mad. You are not like us. That's today. That's today.
See, you can close the door. Thank you.
One more. Brothers came to Abba Anthony and said to him, a saying from Leviticus. So they gave him a line, a verse from Leviticus that they didn't understand, and they asked him to explain it. So the elder went out into the desert, and Abba Ammonus followed him secretly, knowing his usual practice. In other words, he knew that he would go and pray to God for illumination on these things, and so he went secretly and followed him to see what he did to get this illumination. The elder went very far, St. Anthony, standing for prayer, and cried out in a loud voice, O God, send Moses, and he will teach me this saying. And a voice came to him speaking with him. So Abba Ammonus said that though he heard a voice speaking with him, he could not learn the words from it. He hadn't gained the purity of heart to be able to hear exactly what Moses was telling him, but St. Anthony would just go and say, Moses, come tell me what you meant by this. And Moses would speak with him. The saints are taught by God. They're taught by God. Sometimes not so directly, but sometimes very directly. St. Anthony was taught very directly. St. Anthony's life caused an absolute explosion of monastic fervor. There are so many people who saw his life and said, we want to be like him. We want to do what he did. And they ran out of the desert, men and women. And this created what we have called the Desert Fathers and the Desert Mothers. And so you can read about their lives in a book called The Lives of the Desert Fathers. There's also Lives of the Desert Mothers. and you can read these books. There's different versions, and some of them have more, some have less. And so, you know, I always like the thicker ones because they give you a lot more information. In addition to that, you can also find books called The Sayings of the Desert Fathers. And this is one that, two books that everyone should have in their library, The Lives of the Desert Fathers and The Sayings of the Desert Fathers. Some of those sayings are very tough. It's very hard to decipher what exactly they mean, but they're very, very significant, and they're really life-changing books. Okay, next we're going to talk about number two, St. John Climacus. St. John Climacus, he's kind of like St. John Chrysostom. St. John Chrysostom, Chrysostom was not his last name. He meant golden-mouthed because he was such a great preacher. St. John Climacus is the author of The Ladder of Divine Ascent, which became such a famous ascetic book that Climacus means of the ladder, St. John of the Ladder. This is the icon of The Ladder of Divine Ascent. Okay. A very well-known icon. There's different versions of it, but this is probably the most famous. You see the angels here encouraging these monks as they climb the 30 rungs of the ladder. Christ at the top, St. John Climacus up here, and the demons trying to pull them down. And you see people down here, you know, in Hades, you know, begging the prayers of those who are in paradise. Okay. One of the things I always note about this icon, I think this is beautiful theologically, that everyone who's on the ladder and still climbing has their eyes up on Christ. Everyone who's being pulled down by the demons has their eyes anywhere but Christ. That tells us the path to salvation. Keep your eyes on Christ as much as possible. Okay. St. John Climacus, I really, his life isn't really what makes him as well known. It's really the book, The Ladder of Divine Ascent. But I'll tell you a short version of his life, and then we'll talk about that book. So very little is known about his origins. He's probably born in the year 570. He went to Mount Sinai when he was 16, and he submitted himself to an Abba. Abba is the term for father. It's a great elder who you'd submit yourself to an Abba, whose name was Martyrius. And at the age of 20, he was tonsured, and a fellow monk prophesied during his tonsure that he would be a great luminary of the church. He remained in obedience to Abba Martyrius for 19 years until this Abba's death. And then he went and lived for the next 40 years in solitude, in prayer, fasting, and constant tears of repentance. He began displaying works of grace and showed forth great wisdom, so people began flocking to him for advice, which is what would often happen. After those 40 years, he was chosen as the new abbot. One of the remarkable things is he was 75 years old when he was chosen as abbot. So kind of an unheard of thing. They wanted somebody who would be an abbot for a long time. 75 is very old at that point. But they chose him because they recognized his great spiritual heights. He remained in that role for just 4 years. But during those 4 years, he was known as being a clairvoyant. He knew people's thoughts, and he had a great gift of wonder-working. Many miracles he performed at that point. A fellow abbot once wrote to him and asked him to write about the spiritual life. And he didn't really think he had any wisdom, but he was really prodded by this. So out of obedience, he wrote a book, and the book was called The Ladder of Divine Ascent, in which he describes the progress of a Christian in 30 steps. Some of those steps have to do with the acquisition of a virtue, others with instruction of victory over a passion. And so he takes the spiritual life and he describes it as 30 rungs on a ladder. And he talks about going up these rungs and what you need to do. And so he takes all the monastic and ascetic wisdom that had been not lived by him, but also was known around, and he systematizes it in a way. And this is the first time this was really done. He's commemorated twice. He's commemorated on March 30th and on the fourth Sunday of Great Lent. During Great Lent, every year, on the fourth Sunday, we commemorate St. John and the Ladder of Divine Ascent. So some words on this book, on reading the ladder. It is full of great ascetic wisdom. It's full of incredible and memorable sayings and very, very profound stories. But it's not a book that I recommend a lot of people to read cover to cover. That's not really what it's meant for. It's meant more to take particular chapters and to use those chapters if you're struggling with greed, if you're struggling, you know, whatever you're struggling with, or whatever virtue you want to obtain, and going to that particular chapter and really studying that chapter and applying it. Is it a bad thing to read it all the way through? No, it's not bad at all. It's not bad at all. But know that when you're reading a very tough ascetic book, and it may make you go, oh, there's no way I could do this. This is so far from anything that I could live, and I'm going to fall into despair. Don't do that. Okay, don't do that. So if you want to read it, this is probably a book you should ask a blessing to read first. I know there's a few parishioners we have here who read it every year during Lent. They'll take the first 30 days of Lent and they'll read a step a day. And that's not a bad practice. It's a really good practice, but know what you're getting into when you get into that book. This is not Nora Roberts. Isn't that an author? I don't know. I've never read it. Or who's that guy who wrote that? Nicholas Sparks. Yeah, this is not Nicholas Sparks. At least I think it's not. I've never read either of those. So maybe they're a lot like St. John Climacus, and I just don't know. But I saw that terrible movie, and I'm pretty sure that... We do have that in the bookstore. And again, it's a book that probably every Christian should have. And I know a lot of people who, when they were really struggling with a particular passion, they went to that book, and it really changed their life. It gave them a lot of direction and helped them feel understood. There's a more modern version, though, of a book that really addresses the passions and how to fight them. And it's from the French theologian Jean-Claude Larcher. And it's called the Therapy of Spiritual Illnesses, I think is what it's called. It's a 3-volume set. It's expensive. It's $110, I think. We don't get it in the bookstore very often because it's published in Canada. It's harder to get in. But he does the same thing where he goes to the main passions, and he analyzes them from a patristic standpoint. And then in the next volume, he offers the cures for each one. And there have been people in confessions who really struggled with particular passions. And I photocopied those chapters and sent them. And I people have written me back after those chapters and just said, this book is the first time I feel really understood. And I know what direction to take my life. You know, how do I fight? I've struggled with this passion for 40 years, and now I know how to take care of it. So that's a really great book too, or great books, I should say. But again, Ladder of Divine Ascent is something that people, I think, should have. Just know what you're getting into when you read it, okay? So a few quotes from the Ladder of Divine Ascent. It is not the one who reproaches himself who shows humility, for who will not put up with himself? It is the one who is slandered by another yet continues to show love for him. That's a good saying. That's a good quote. Another quote. Whoever is proud of his natural gifts, intelligence, learning, skill in reading, clear enunciation, and other similar qualities, which are acquired without much labor, will never obtain supernatural gifts. Whoever is not faithful in small things is also unable in large things and is vainglorious. And finally, a little bit of a longer one. It often happens that God humbles the vainglorious, sending a sudden misfortune. If prayer does not destroy a proud thought, we bring to mind the departure of the soul from this life. And if this does not help, let us fear the shame which follows dishonor. For whoever humbles himself shall be exalted, and whoever exalts himself shall be humbled. Luke 14. When those who praise us, or rather seduce us, when somebody praises you, that's how you should consider it as seduction. Starts to praise us. Let us recall our many sins. Then we shall find that we are not worthy of what they say or do to honor us. It's very, very cautious about obtaining humility and not being vainglorious. It's really good advice. So, wide eyes. So. Okay, now one that you probably haven't heard about. Maybe you have, but this is one that's not as well known, especially in English-speaking worlds, but one of the most significant saints of the 20th century. Of the second millennium. He didn't live that long. He was born in 1722. So his name is St. Paisius Velichakovsky. St. Paisius Velichakovsky. You will recognize his icon by his absolutely... talk about jealousy. This is what I'll have to work on. I have to be very jealous of his beard. I will never have a beard like this. Down in Arizona, there is the monastery of St. Anthony's. That's the male monastery. And then there's the female monastery of St. Paisios. And it's this St. Paisios, Paisios Velichakovsky. There's a really well-known image of him. Let me see if we can find it really. Oh, here it is. This is an older, more westernized icon of him, but this is one that you'll see very often. Believe it or not, his life, there are three versions in English, three different versions of his life. I mean, this is a really significant saint, but again, not as well known. I'll get there. Let me tell you why he's so significant. He was born in 1722 in Russia. He was the 11th of 12 children, and his father was a priest. This was a time in which monasticism was very much on the decline. It was in the decline for two reasons. In the Greek-speaking worlds, what's happening? What empire is it?
The Ottoman Empire.
You have the Turks in charge. And so a lot of monasteries are in ruins. They're being destroyed. The faith is not being propagated. A lot of times they go through various periods where sometimes there's open persecution. You're not allowed to preach publicly. And so the people aren't very well educated in their faith. And what's happening in Russia at that time? I know that's not your century, but...
Oh, it's the... during the 17th century? Or the 18th century?
17th and 18th, yeah.
The second time of troubles.
there's a big westernization, right, during this time as well. And so that spirit of deep ascetic piety that had been learned is really falling away. And so a lot of monasteries are becoming very evangelical in the sense that they're living outward gospel lives, but they've lost the sense of what true prayer is. That deep asceticism of what we just talked about with St. Anthony and St. John Climacus isn't really being lived. You know, and so this is what the world he's born into. At the age of 17, he decided to become a monk. And so he sought out a great spiritual guide because he had read some of the lives of the saints and he went, I want to be like this. So I need someone to teach me. This is one of the common understandings of the spiritual life is that if you want to be greater, you need to find someone who's greater, who will guide you in that way. So he goes from monastery to monastery for 7 years. He goes to all the, reading his life, it was hard to follow all the places he went, but he just never felt home at any of them. He never felt this great sense of grace at any of them. There's a little story that I want to tell you. He went to Kiev. Kiev is a place, I mean, the Kiev Caves, Lavra, is one of the greatest monasteries, so many great ascetics. He was expecting to find some really great people there. He happened to meet his sister-in-law there, who was the widow of his older brother, Archpriest John, who had proposed. And she informed him that his mother was so sorrowful when he left. She was so sorrowful. And her mind now seemed to be affected by her grief. She seemed to be going a little bit crazy from her grief of him having left. Then, one day, an angel appeared to her and told her that instead of loving the Creator with all her heart and soul, she seemed to love his creation, her son, a lot more. She's falling away from the faith because she's so grieved over her son. And because of this excessive love, the angel continued, she was thinking of starving herself to death, which would result in her eternal condemnation, the angel told her. If you starve yourself to death at suicide, you will be condemned eternally. So stop worrying about your son so much. Start worrying about God a lot more. The angel said to console her that by God's grace, her son would become a monk and that she would also renounce the world and someday become a nun if she would repent. So after this, she became calm and she accepted God's will for her son. And indeed, she entered a convent and was tonsured with the name Juliana. And after 10 years or so, she departed to the Lord. So God is intervening in very strong ways in this family's life and protecting this son and this family because he's going to become something really great. So he's at one monastery. There's one day. It's incredible. How many times do we sleep in past our morning prayers? And we're just like, well, I'll make up for it tomorrow and do the best I can. There's one day where he slept in and he didn't hear the call to prayer. You know, they bang what's called the talent on it's called a prayer. Well, he didn't hear it and he slept through. And he was so upset, he was completely inconsolable. And the abbot tried to calm him down. It's not that big of a deal. Like, relax. Like, we can calm down. This isn't the worst thing in the world. But again, he wanted toughness. He wanted ascetic toughness. And so he made a decision. I will never again sleep lying down. I will just lean against a wall. I'll sit up so that I'm never too deep in sleep and I'll never miss the call to prayer again. This is an iron will again. After going to one other monastery, he began to progress quite quickly. He learned to overcome the passions, the demons, and he gained at that point unceasing prayer. This is where he really learned unceasing prayer and hesychism. At the age of 24, he decides to go to Mount Athos. He still wants this great spiritual guide. He thinks nothing of himself. Unceasing prayer, big deal. Not sleeping, lying down ever, big deal. I need someone to really teach me the spiritual life. It was his idea. So he continues to search for a great spiritual guide. And eventually a fellow monk and struggler was seeking the same thing. And so they went out together to look for a great guide together. And eventually this fellow monk goes, do you think that maybe I should stop seeking for a great guide and just take you as my guide? Because, you know, you're a great ascetic and you're a great man of prayer and you have a lot of grace. And St. Paisius goes, are you deluded? Of course not. But the monk refuses to listen to him And for 3 days, he weeps and begs him over and over and over and over again until finally, out of obedience, St. Paisius goes, fine, but I will not take you as a disciple. I'll take you as a fellow struggler and friend, and that's it. The guy goes, all right, good enough. But eventually, other monks take notice of St. Paisius, and after many refusals, he finally agrees to be ordained and to become their confessor. So he's being recognized, despite the fact that he thinks nothing of himself, he's being recognized by everyone around him for being the very thing that he was always seeking. Now, I want to tell you why that I think this is so significant. You read his story up to this point, and besides a couple little miraculous events, this is just like he goes to a monastery, it doesn't quite work out. He goes next month, it doesn't quite work out. And you could sit there and go, where's the hand of God here? Like, where's the great wisdom? Where's the great grace? God had a plan all along, and he becomes really great in this. You know whose story is very similar to his? St. Joseph the Hesychast, who reposed in 1959. We'll talk about him next week. He had the same thing where he was constantly looking for a great guide and couldn't find one until God just gave him unceasing prayer. And then everyone's like, this is the guy. You're the one you've been looking for, you know? So he stays on Mount Athos for 17 years. Now is where the real influence becomes very, very big. In wanting to learn more and more deeply about prayer, he discovers these manuscripts from these more ancient saints that really describe the process of hesychism, this pure prayer and unceasing prayer. And he begins reading them, and he begins noticing that different manuscripts have slightly different wording in some areas. And he goes, you know, maybe I need to start collecting these manuscripts and correcting them. And then I need to start translating them so that Slavic-speaking people can actually read them themselves. He knew many languages. And so he starts doing this process. And he spends hours every day, little by little, correcting one sentence at a time, going through everything, you know, checking multiple manuscripts, finding which ones are older, finding out which the proper translation is, and then translating it into other languages. Eventually, he moves to Moldova, which is you know, northeast of Romania. Romania also has a Moldovan section. And many more monks join him. And he continues this work. He'd taken a lot of manuscripts with him, and he'd write to monasteries asking for theirs. After 12 years, there are 350 monks under his care. He began correcting Slavic translations as well of the fathers based on the works that he had found on Mount Athos, the Greek texts he had found. So now he's finding already translated things and correcting them against the Greek texts he had had. He makes two more moves. First, he goes to Secu Monastery in Romania, and Secu proves to be not large enough for all the monks that want to be in his care. And so he moves to Niamps. Niamps and Secu are very near each other. So I've actually been to both monasteries, and you go to Niamps and then you go down the road and there's Secu, and you go, and Secu is where I met one of my favorite monks in the world. The first time I met him, he's the most joyful, Father Calliste. He was like one of the most joyful men I've ever met in my life. I loved him so much. And so the second time we went, I was so excited to see him again. He had died very suddenly, and he wasn't even buried there. It was really sad for me, so I have him on my prayer list. I always pray for him. I love my picture with him. He just sits there with his slightly, you know, cocked head to the side and just big smile. And he's such a radiant man. So I have a great love for Secu and a great love for Niamps. And then you go a little further, and there's Sihastria, where Elder Cleopa, we'll talk about him next week, was. So it's incredible being in Romania, where you go, oh, massively famous monastery. Oh, massively famous monastery. Oh, massively famous monastery. And, I mean, you could walk from one to the other in less than a day easily, very close to each other. So he goes to Niamps, which had much more room. The prince is the one who forced him there. He goes, you know, there's a lot more people who want to be your disciples. You need to go someplace bigger. And he goes, no, I'm fine here. No, out of obedience, go. So he goes to Niamps, and he spends his last 15 years there. And during those 15 years, while guiding the monks and guiding visitors, he's constantly working on these translations and correcting manuscripts. By the time of his death in 1794, there are about 1,000 monks under his care. 1,000 monks under his care. His relics remain in Niamps. They're incorrupt to this day. And that's what I was going to tell you, a little interesting thing. I've been able to venerate them a couple times. It's one of the great joys of my life, is being able to venerate the relics of St. Paisius Veličikovský. It's absolutely incredible. He's commemorated on November 15th. I told you that monastery in Arizona is named after him. So why did I bring him up when he's not as well known? There aren't a lot of writings from him, by the way. There's a little series called The Little Russian Philokalia that Father Seraphim Rose had put together, and one volume is of St. Paisius' writings. One tiny volume is all the writings of his we have. Most of his work was translated and everything. But I will tell you, his legacy wasn't so much in his writings. It's that all of Orthodox monasticism around the world was revitalized by this one man. people began seeking pure prayer and hesychism again because of him. And you're going to see his influence again and again and again in the saints that we talk about from now on. Massive influence. He is massively underappreciated. When Father Seraphim Rose translated his life, it wasn't a great seller. And that's really unfortunate. We should really know more about him. It's just an incredible man. We owe a lot to him. The monasteries in America wouldn't exist the way they are now if it weren't for him. This one man had such great influence. So what an incredible saint. So, okay, short version. I'm just going to give you a little introduction to Saint Nicodemus the Hagiorite of Mount Athos. Saint Nicodemus is the Greek pronunciation. It's what I'm used to. Nicodemus is how we would normally say it in the West. But just so you know, I'll never get out of that habit, Saint Nicodemus. So just a short thing, because again, he had a great influence. I don't want to go too much through his life, because we have a lot to get through still, and there's some I really want to spend a lot more time on, but I want you to at least be familiar with his name. So Saint Nicodemus was born in 1748 in Naxos, Greece, so not too long after Saint Paisios. He studied many languages, and he showed profound intellect at a young age. At the age of 26, he went to Mount Athos, and under the guidance of Saint Macarius of Corinth, who was a bishop, who recognized St. Nicodemus' great brilliance and his great focus. And you notice how focused he could be. He had Nicodemus begin editing manuscripts of various practical, ascetical, and hesychistic works from the fathers of the 4th to 15th centuries, and then compiling those together. And that became known as the Philokalia, all these works that he compiled together. They have to do mostly with prayer, but also with practical and other aspects of the faith. So in The Way of a Pilgrim, when he mentions the Philokalia, which means the love of wisdom, this five-volume set, and all five volumes have been translated, you can get in English. But these were, we compiled, it says on the cover, compiled by St. Nicodemus and Macarius of Corinth. So this was one of the great things that he did, and that he's very well known for. By the way, there's a harder to find version of the Philokalia, and there's only two volumes that were published because the man who was translating them, he reposed after doing two volumes. His name was Constantine Kavarnos. He became a monk shortly before his death and then reposed. He does a better translation, and he puts them in the order that they're meant to be read. These are not meant to be read volume one, volume two, then volume three. There's certain practical things that are read first, and then as you progress, you get to the more difficult things. And so he has two volumes. If I can get them in the bookstore, I will, but they're tough to find. They're not always in publication. So St. Nicodemus had the scriptures basically memorized all the way through, including chapter and verse. It's incredible intellect. He also heavily edited a Catholic ascetic work called Unseen Warfare. I know some people here have read that and really been profoundly affected by it, and that's available today in English. And there's another name attached to it because it was further edited later on by a Russian saint. We're going to get to him in a minute. He compiled a full book with commentary of the canons of the church. It's called The Rudder. So he took all the canons of the ecumenical councils and some local councils and put them in one book and added commentary. It's called The Rudder. You can find that online, used versions for about $2,000. Good luck. But someone I know has a PDF of the whole thing on his computer in his office right over there. So he had a great love for the lives of the saints. He made a three-volume set of the lives of the saints. He wrote many other things, especially instructions to priests, his most famous work being what's called the Exomologatarion, which is a guide to confession. A lot of these things have been translated recently. He reposed in 1809 at the age of just 60, and he's commemorated on July 14th. I want to make sure I keep remembering to give you at least some icons so you can see. See at least what these figures look like. And for some reason, my internet is stalling. So, okay, well, while that pulls up, we'll get to the next figure. And I told you that there was a Russian figure who also worked on Unseen Warfare. That was St. Theophan the Recluse. St. Theophan had a really fascinating life. Again, we'll go through the life quickly, but it's important you know about him because his writings are so important. He was born in 1815, okay? You see we're kind of going in chronological order here. He attended a military academy and then Kiev Theological Academy. Not everyone who went to theological academies, by the way, necessarily, this is St. Nicodemus, by the way. Of course, I click on it to make it bigger, and there we go. There's St. Nicodemus. This is a typical icon of him. Okay. He went to this theological seminary, which is not necessarily something that you go to if you want to be a priest. Some people would just go there for, you know, regular education. But he very much wanted to become a monk. Here's St. Theophon. Mountain Supply. He very much wanted to become a monk, and so even before he had completed his studies, he was tonsured a monk. He was widely recognized, like many of these men, for his great piety and brilliance. This is true of a lot of these saints, but not all of them. Like St. Anthony wasn't recognized at a young age for his brilliance. He was uneducated. So that's not always the most important thing, but a lot of times for these theological works, it becomes important. He was made the rector, which is essentially the head priest, of a couple different church schools and seminaries, as well as a teacher. But he really wasn't happy with his academic work. He was sent for a short time to Jerusalem and then Constantinople, but then he was recalled back to Russia. In 1859, he was made a bishop. And he was very, very gentle with the people. He had a great love for his people, and he was so gentle with them that when someone had to be reprimanded, he would assign a different priest to that task. You go take care of that. You know, because he just didn't want to deal with this. But he also didn't like that he had to deal with all these worldly situations. He found that, you know, people could be very petty, and he really wanted to focus on a higher spiritual life. So after just 7 years as a bishop, he asks to be relieved of his duties. And instead he's made superior. He didn't really want to do this, but there were others who really loved him, and they said, all right, we'll let you resign, but then you need to be made the superior of a monastery. So there's a monastery called in Visha, and he was made superior there, but very soon after, he resigned from that as well. He really just wanted a life of seclusion. And so for 6 years, he had built a small cell on the outskirts of the monastery, but he'd attend all the services. And then he built this small chapel where he would serve just Sundays and major feasts in his small chapel. And by that point, after those 6 years, he starts cutting off the relationships that he has with everybody except for his confessor. And this is why he's known as the recluse. For the final 11 years, he basically locks himself in his room and he serves daily services. And then he works on writing. He wrote many works and answered many letters. He also translated the Philokalia into Russian. And the works of various fathers, especially of St. Simeon, the new theologian. He also painted some icons, and he worked as a carpenter. He reposed in 1894 at the age of 79. His works, the reason that his works are so significant for us is because he took all the patristic wisdom before him, and he tried to disseminate it in a way that was very simple and straightforward, more for modern man. Modern man at his time, you know, but they're still very accessible to us. That St. Paisius Monastery down in Arizona, that's the one that actually publishes most of his works. And there's two works in particular. He wrote many other things, but there's two works in particular that people, again, should have in their libraries. One is called The Path to Salvation. He goes through one's entire life and what salvation looks like. Baptism, what that means for you, repentance. He goes through everything. You know, childhood, how should we raise our children, everything. And very simple and straightforward. There's another book called The Spiritual Life and How to Be Attuned to It. And in this book, he writes letters to a spiritual daughter. Now, the first part of this book, the first, I think, 13 chapters are the ones that I told you are difficult. And I wrote a summary of those in that one-page summary I gave you some weeks ago. And it's on the resources of the catechumen page. If you go to the catechumen lectures, there's resources and it's down there. But both works are very, very well known, well revered, and very helpful. Very, very helpful. And just very plain language for everybody. When you read some of the more ancient fathers, you sit there and go, without this experience, I don't really know what they're saying. But with St. Theophon, he makes it just much more down to earth for us. He further also revised Unseen Warfare, even more so than St. Nicodemus had done by that point. I mean, you can imagine, he reposes in 1894, right? And St. Nicodemus reposed in 1809. So, you know, this is, you know, about 90 years apart, 85 years apart. And Unseen Warfare, St. Nicodemus' version, was already translated into Russian, you know, and was well available there. And St. Theophon read it and thought that it needed a little bit more editing, so he edited it some more, and that became the version that we have today in English. And you'll see on the cover or on the inside cover, it'll often say that it was edited and revised by St. Nicodemus and St. Theophon the recluse. He wrote many other works, by the way. Quite a few are available in English. There's one I've been wanting to read forever, and I just haven't gotten to it. He has a book that's just a commentary on Psalm 118. Psalm 118 is the really long one, and he has a commentary, and it's supposed to be incredible. And every time I go to it, I'm like, I want to read this next, and I get distracted with something else. So, God willing, 2022 is going to be the year for that book. So, all right. 5:30. We're doing okay on time. Maybe I'll be able to tell you a little bit about that one that I didn't get to. St. Ignatius. So, okay, this one's probably the longest life I have because it's worth it. You're going to like these next two. St. Seraphim of Sarov. St. Seraphim of Sarov, when you go up in the church, on those icon stands in the back, on the far left, that's St. Seraphim. St. Seraphim of Sarov is one of the most beloved saints of the church. Absolutely revered. He was born in 1759 in Kursk, Russia. At the age of 10, he became very severely ill, and it looked as if he was probably going to die. But during this lengthy illness, in his sleep, he saw the Theotokos appear to him, and she promised to heal him. And a few days later, there was a miracle-working icon of the Theotokos that was being processed through the city. And because of the weather, or I forget if it was the weather or what it was, but they had to reroute, and they had to reroute right past his house. And so his mother picked up Seraphim in her arms and held him up to the icon. And very soon after that, he began to recover. So this was the Theotokos' healing. I'll show you a couple icons of him. Here's one. And then I want to show you, this is kind of the one we have upstairs. Okay. This is a famous scene from his life we'll talk about in just a minute, where he's kneeling on a rock. I'll talk about that. Okay. And then he's probably best known for something in particular, a friendship he had. And that friendship was with a bear. So yeah, a lot of you already know that. So there's a lot of icons of that as well. But we'll get there. Okay, so after this healing, he spends a lot of his time in childhood not playing with other kids, not doing, you know, silly games and stuff. Rather, he spends most of his time in church or reading the lives of the saints, or he loved to find seclusion in secluded places just to pray. He just had a great love for prayer right from the start. At the age of 18, he decides to become a monk, and right from the beginning, he was highly dedicated to praying much, to eating very little. He would eat only once a day and nothing on Wednesdays and Fridays. Wednesdays and Fridays he wouldn't eat at all. And the other days just once a day and very little. And sleeping very little. Not long after the joining the monastery, he received the blessing to withdraw into the forest every now and then to pray. But after going into the forest, he becomes ill again. And he's forced to spend all his time in the monastery. But not just that, 3 years lying down. For 3 years he was ill. And couldn't find healing. Until finally, the Theotokos appears to him again, this time accompanied by many other saints, and heals him. In the vision, the Theotokos spoke to the apostle John the theologian, and she points to Seraphim and says, and then says to St. John, he is of our lineage. So this is a clear declaration of his holiness, that he's in the line of the spiritual line of the Theotokos and John the theologian, an evangelist. In his late 20s, he's made a deacon. During the services, he would very often see angels. And then one day when he goes out to do petitions, he looks at the icon of Christ and Christ appears to him. He sees Christ. And this vision is so powerful and so profound, he's struck dumb and he just stands there, stunned. So the other monks, after this prolonged silence, realize, oh, he didn't lose his place. Something's happened. They go and check on him, and they can't get him out of this state of ecstasy, and they realize he must have seen some sort of vision, and they have to carry him out of church. It's the only way they can get him out of there. After being made a hieromonk, which is a priest monk, he began going about 5 kilometers into the forest to a very small hermitage he had there. And this is where he formed that friendship with the bear. And this is where we know about this because a woman went to visit him once, and she saw this bear running towards him, and she starts screaming, "Father Seraphim, watch out, there's a bear!" And he goes, "Yeah, what's the big deal? This is my friend." And he feeds him and pets him, and he goes, "Okay, she's scared of you, go on, and he goes off. One day, when he's out in the forest, a couple of robbers come across him, and they want to steal from him. He explains to them that he's a monk, he doesn't have anything, but they don't believe him. They think he's lying and just trying to preserve whatever he has. And he has an axe with him, and he's very strong. But rather than attack them, he lays down the axe on the ground. He crosses his arms across his chest like we do before communion. He says, do whatever you what must be done. And they beat him so badly that blood is pouring out of his face. And they stopped only when they thought he was dead. He was beaten so poorly. Because of this beating, he was hunched over for the rest of his life. And this is why in many icons you'll see him hunched over, and he'd use the axe that was there as his crutch. And that's what he would walk along with. But the story didn't end there. The men were caught. And the judge asked Seraphim to come and explain what had happened. But he doesn't testify against them. Instead, he intercedes for them on their behalf in front of the judge. These aren't the men. Don't worry about them. They didn't mean it. And so they don't get into trouble, and obviously, you know, pretty transformed from his great forgiveness. Soon after this, he began a very incredible ascetic feat. He spends 1,000 days during the day, all day, he would kneel on a rock with outstretched arms and pray the Jesus prayer. 1,000 days. Eventually, the Theotokos appeared to him again in his seclusion and told him to return to the monastery, but to shut himself in his cell without seeing anyone. And after some time, she appeared again and told him, okay, now keep doing what you're doing, but open the door, but don't speak to anybody. Just let people witness. Finally, she appeared again and told him, now begin seeing people and counsel them. So this is where he became a great counselor, and his fame spread throughout all of Russia. He would call everyone my joy. And when he would meet people, instead of them bowing to him, he would bow down to them, full prostration, and kiss their hands. His most common piece of advice is one of his most famous sayings, acquire the spirit of peace and thousands around you will be saved. It's his most famous line. Acquire the Holy Spirit and thousands around you will be saved. One of the things that everybody should read, I've mentioned this before, everybody should read this, is his conversation with his spiritual child, Motovilov, which is entitled On the Acquisition of the Holy Spirit. And this is where he describes in very simple terms that the whole point of this life, everything the church gives us, everything we do, is with the purpose of acquiring the Holy Spirit more and more. Everyone should read that account. It's incredible. In that account, he begins shining brightly with the uncreated light. And Motovilov says, I can barely make out the features of your face. I can barely look at you at all. It's so bright. St. Seraphim goes, well, you can't see it, but you're shining like this too. It's an incredible account. His very practical advice, he would teach people just to pray a little bit every day. He had a very short prayer rule for people who were busy. He said, do this and fast on Wednesdays and Fridays, and you could attain a certain level of perfection, even if you just do this very faithfully. And just love God. He was a great clairvoyant. He advised most people just to be joyful. Be joyful in the Christian life. He'd say, this is really important. You should be known for your joy. Many, many miracles. A miraculous spring is still available that came up by his feet. He had many holy spiritual children. One of the most amazing things he did, a lot of people don't know about this, is he wrote a letter to Tsar Nicholas II. Well, he didn't live at that time, did he? But he knew what was going to happen. And so he prophesied. We don't really know the whole content of the letter, but it said that when Tsar Nicholas was given this letter from the saint who lived a long time before him, he was struck into silence and probably predicted the Bolshevik Revolution, told him what was going to happen to his family and strengthened his family for their martyrdoms. There are multiple lives available of Saint Seraphim in English, but there's two that I would recommend the most. Now, you're going to laugh when I say this. I recommend this first one, but I haven't read it yet. But I've heard nothing but good things. I know stuff from this author, and so I know it's probably very, very good. It's, again, on my list. Hopefully 2022 I can finally read it. But it's called Saint Seraphim, Wonderworker of Sarov, by Helen Kontsevich. It's Kontsevich. You can get it from St. Herman Monastery. I don't know if it's still in publication, but if it's not, let me know. I can find some copies. St. Seraphim, Wonderworker of Sarov. The other one, which I have read and I really loved, is by Archimandrite Lazarus Moore, M-O-O-R-E, and it's called An Extraordinary Peace, St. Seraphim, Flame of Sarov. An extraordinary piece. Okay, it used to be under a different title, and then it was reorganized and given this new title. So you may find it in with a different title, but it's a really fantastic book about his life and teachings. Saint Seraphim of Sarov is one of the most beloved saints of the whole Orthodox Church. He's loved everywhere, and people recognize him for there was such a simplicity and purity about his life and his teachings, where he takes, again, difficult concepts and just distills them, and such a warmth in everything you read about him. So highly recommend that. Everybody should read A Life of St. Seraphim at some point. Believe me, you'll see why. It's an incredible thing. Okay, now, maybe finally, I'm not going to, again, I have an eighth, but I just didn't have time, so I can tell you just a little bit about him. But by the way, St. Seraphim Sarov, his whole entire ascetic life, inspired by, I mean, Sarov Monastery. What were they based on? St. Paisius Velichakovsky. Very much so. St. Paisius Velichakovsky also deeply influenced other monasteries of Russia. And there's one monastery that you should all know about, and that's called Optina, the Optina Monastery. So I'll tell you about Optina Monastery, and then I'll tell you about a particular saint from there. In 1821, Optina Monastery, which is a monastery near a river in a deeply forested area that's about 160 miles outside of Russia. It's about, southwest of, if I remember right, of Moscow. It began to be the home of a long series of great ascetics and men of prayer that would come to be known as the Optina Elders. In all, the Optina Elders consists of a line of 14 saints who all come from this Optina tradition, and the only reason that this line ended is because of the Bolshevik Revolution and communism, when they went in and really destroyed Optina. It would have continued on had it not been for that. These elders include abbots. The abbots would really oversee the running of the monastery, the administration of the monastery, and elders. And so the abbot wasn't the elder. These were two separate positions. The abbot would oversee the running of the monastery, and the elder was the one who everyone would confess to. And when one of the elders would die, they would elect somebody else to take over. And they would look for the person who had the greatest spiritual purity to take over in that sense. But it wasn't just of the monastery. It was also of the thousands upon thousands of visitors who would come to Optina because of its fame. As it grew, more and more visitors came, and they always wanted to see the elder. Based in the tradition of St. Paisius Velichakovsky, I told you need to know that, the first of these saints were brothers. They were Saints Moses and Anthony, and they came from monasteries that had been directed by direct disciples. They'd been headed up by direct disciples of St. Paisius. So St. Paisius Velichakovsky, with 1,000 monks under him, had some who became very well-known elders themselves and then went to these other monasteries. And one of these monasteries was, one of these disciples was the abbot of the monastery that Saints Moses and Anthony came from. So they're essentially spiritual grandchildren of St. Paisius Velichakovsky. So Saints Moses and Anthony were chosen by a metropolitan to go and revitalize Optina. So one became the abbot, the other became the elder, and they began this tradition that continued on and on and on. Eventually, to them was added Saint Leonid, who was known as the first really great spiritual elder of the monastery. I don't know if it's on there yet. I sent it to Joe yesterday, so it may be on there already. But on the website, under the resources, there's an article, ironically, from St. Paisius Monastery in Arizona. It's long. It's a long article. I'm going to tell you, it's long. It is worth your time. I want everyone to read it. Really, I want you to read this. It is the best article I've ever seen that goes through the entire history of Optina Monastery and talks about all 14 of these saints. So it goes through each one and gives you a good amount of detail where it's not too much and not too little. But because there's 14, it's long. It goes through all their personalities. But it's an incredible article. So that's linked on the Catechumen page, or it will be very soon. St. Herman of Alaska Press from Platina in California, they've published 9 volumes of the Lives of the Optina Elders. 2 other volumes have been published by Holy Transfiguration Monastery. So that's 11 of the 14. St. Herman Press, actually, just in the past year, has published the most recent 2. I thought they were done, but they published the most recent 2, so I haven't read those yet. Volume 4 from St. Herman Press is about probably the most famous of these God-bearing elders, what's in Russia known as a staretz. And the most famous of these was St. Ambrose of Optina, of the of the five volumes I've read so far, and I've read the two from Holy Transfiguration Monastery, so I guess I've read about seven of them, this one was by far my favorite. And we have a couple of them in the bookstore. There's another smaller book on St. Ambrose that's also very good, but it's not as readily available. So this is the one I would recommend. It's from St. Herman Monastery on St. Ambrose of Optina. If you're going to only read one volume about the Optina elders, that's the one to read. Now that may change as I read some of the later volumes, but I'm telling you, St. Ambrose is the most famous. So I want to tell you just about him. So now you have a little bit of familiarity with what Optina Monastery was, and I want to tell you about St. Ambrose. He was born in 1812 into a priestly family. Again, like many people, very well educated. He went to seminary where he excelled, and he was among the top of his class. But he had no intention of becoming a priest or monk. You're going to see that his life starts off very differently from a lot of the saints we've talked about. You notice a lot of them, like 16, 17, 18, they're like, I want to be a monk. Not St. Ambrose. St. Ambrose, he graduates, and he wants to be a teacher. He has no interest in becoming a priest or monk. But he becomes, 1 year after his graduation, he becomes very ill. And he becomes so ill that he's afraid he's on his deathbed. And so he makes a promise to God. He says, God, if you heal me, I will serve you. I will serve you. And sure enough, God heals him. And so what does St. Ambrose do? Forgets his promise. Just forgets about it. And so he goes and he teaches. In 1839, he visits this very well-known elder named Hilarion. And Hilarion looks at him and says, you need to go to Optina because you're greatly needed there. And so what does he do? He ignores this. Come on. I would rather teach. God gives him sign after sign after sign after sign. You need to keep your promise to me. But he doesn't listen. And then finally, one night, something very simple happens. He has a night of frivolity with a lot of his friends. Lots of jokes being thrown. He is the center of attention. And he is the life of the party. And as after everyone goes home, his conscience begins to really weigh on him. And he becomes disgusted with himself. Look at you. You made this promise to God. And all you care about are other people's praises. You don't care about what God thinks about you. You've had all these things happen. This elder tells you to go to Optina. And here you are basking in the praise of others. You'll be condemned. You will be condemned in the end. And so the very next day, he gets up. He goes to his teaching job. Gives them his resignation. And then he leaves and starts making the trip to Optina. He was guided by Saints Leonid and Saint Macarius. Saint Macarius, after Saint Leonid, became the elder of the monastery. And so Saint Macarius has become his cell attendant. And so the elders and the abbots would often have a cell attendant, a younger monk, to take care of just like the everyday simple stuff. You know, like start the tea, you know, get me this book, go tell this person, so that they could focus more fully on prayer and on advising the people. And so he becomes the cell attendant. After 6 years as St. Macarius, and St. Macarius was a great, incredible elder, absolutely great spiritual guide, a man full of grace, wonder-working, incredible man. After 6 years there, he becomes ill again. And this time he bears his illness without complaint, but it takes him 2 years to recover. And after that, he's only able to walk with a cane. So this illness really takes a toll on his body that lasts for the rest of his life. When St. Macarius, who again was the starch of the monastery at the time, reposes, there's quite a few candidates to take over. But miraculously, every one of them starts to get ill and dies as well. And the last one standing is St. Ambrose, and he becomes the obvious choice. And so they elect him as the new starets. He spends much of the rest of his life, he's very ill. He spends much of his time in bed. But he constantly receives visitors. He rarely gave his own opinion on anything. It was very tough to get his personal opinion. He would just simply refer to the wisdom of the fathers. That's all he would do. He'd just say, this is what the fathers say. Just do this. There is a story. I don't think I put it down here. Nope, I did put it down here. I'm going to tell you, there's a great story about him because when practical wisdom was needed, he would give it. And there's a kind of an interesting story about that. I'll tell you in a minute. He constantly refers to the Holy Fathers, a lot of whom he had memorized. Eventually, he founds a women's convent. He was also visited by two very famous personalities, Tolstoy and Dostoevsky, both visited him. Tolstoy visited him like four times. Is that right? Four times? And Dostoevsky visited him when he was very depressed. Dostoevsky's son had suddenly died. And Dostoevsky was, his personality was kind of given over to depression. He had a very difficult life. And in his Great Depression, he goes to talk with St. Ambrose, and his St. Ambrose's grace-filled personality and his counsel have a very profound effect on him. And a lot of people think that St. Ambrose was probably the main influencer of the elder Zosima in the Brothers Karamazov. So these are two famous people who visited him, but many other people would come from all over the country to visit St. Ambrose. He was very well known, such purity of heart. There's a paragraph from the article I mentioned from St. Pius's Monastery, and I want to read you this paragraph about him. It gives you kind of a sense of his approach to things. It says, on the death of Starts Makarios in 1860, Ambrose was called to exercise a ministry that soon extended to the whole of Russia. Rich and poor, learned and unlettered, nobles and simple folk, noted members of the intelligentsia, they all made their way to this bedridden man as to a prophet newly risen among them, seeking a word of counsel or of consolation in their distress, a word of salvation that was to order their entire life, a call to repentance, or a simple blessing. Despite his physical weakness and his ailments, Ambrose received them all cheerfully and would adapt his manner and his words to each person so that after conversing with this Starets of Optina, the life of many of his visitors completely changed. People would have one visit with him and their whole life would change. People who spoke with him noticed how he could pass immediately from the discussion of high theology to the solution of practical problems of everyday life. So this is the story I want to tell. This is kind of a funny story. Someone once criticized him one day for wasting his time, spending a long time advising a peasant woman how to feed her turkeys. And he replied, "Don't you understand that her whole life is bound up with these turkeys, and that the peace of her soul is of no less account than that of those who come to me with questions about sublime matters?" Isn't that incredible? So I have such love for every little thing. The writer Tolstoy visited the Starets and was greatly edified him. "I did no more than converse with him," he wrote, "and somehow my soul lost all heaviness. When you talk with such a man, you feel the nearness of God." Another writer speaks of, quote, "an unfathomable abyss of charity within the Starets, whose love was extended to all." Now, being a Starets, especially at Optina, was a very, very difficult ascetic feat. Why do I call it ascetic feat? Because these are people who wanted to dedicate their life to prayer and fasting, and yet they have no time to pray during the day. You can read in that article, it'll describe his day and how he would divide it up into certain hours. He had just a little time for prayer, little time for eating, but mainly it was receiving visitors constantly for hours and hours every day. And along with those visitors, he would also receive about 40 letters a day. Now, the amazing thing about this is he would often answer these letters. He would dictate answers without having ever opened the letter. This was very common for him. He'd receive a letter, and he'd know exactly who wrote it and what they were asking about, and he'd write down the answers. Many of the Optina elders would do this. I read a story about St. Nectari of Optina, who there was one man who was really struggling with doubts about the faith, and he was one of the intelligentsia, and he thought, come on, can this really be real? And he had met Elder Nectari, and he was pretty impressed with him. And one day, it all came to a head, and he goes, "These questions are so heavy on me, I've got to write him a letter, and I have to get answers to these questions." So he writes him a letter, and he sends it off, and the same mailman who took the letter from him hands him a reply. It hadn't even gotten to him yet, and it had all the answers to his questions. So the Optina elders, would do these types of things. This is not unusual. But St. Ambrose, listen to this. This is incredible. He received visitors up into the last hour of his life. In his last hour of life, he was still receiving visitors. He could barely move. He could barely talk. But this was what God had given him, and he thought this was his job. He reposed in the year 1891, and he was, I believe his were one of some of the relics that were incorrupt when they were finally exhumed. So that's St. Ambrose of Optina. So it's one of my favorites. I have a great love for St. Ambrose and all the Optina elders. It's just incredible saints. So, okay, I thought we weren't going to have time for an eighth. We really don't have time for an eighth. I just want to mention a couple things about him. I was going to talk about St. Ignatius Brancheininov. He's another one of these saints who is becoming better and better known in English-speaking worlds because as his writings get translated. And you know that on the catechumen book list, we have The Field, which is an incredible book. I mean, absolutely astounding. You get the sense of it, of his great spirituality and brilliance in that book. Along with that, there's another book called The Refuge, which we have in the bookstore that's been translated, and his most famous work, The Arena. The Arena, which is his guide to monastics, but it's also read by many laymen who have found a lot of benefit. St. Ignatius, he was mainly taught by St. Leonid of Optina. So you see how this line spreads out everywhere. And St. Leonid, again, was somebody who was contemporaries with St. Ambrose, and all these were taught by disciples of St. Paisios. So St. Paisios really had influence everywhere. St. Paisios Velichkovsky. St. Ignatius spent, he had a very fascinating life. I wish I could share it with you. If you want to read it, there's a very long version. It's beautiful on the OCA website. If you go to oca.org and look up St. Ignatius Brancheninov, and you can read about his life. It's a very beautiful life. He had a lot of suffering, a lot of physical ailments, but that inspired a lot of his writings. And he was just a spiritual giant, an absolute spiritual giant. And that's why his writings are so beloved in the church. And so I'm so happy that so many of these things, you know, just a few years ago, besides The Arena, nothing was translated of St. Ignatius. And now we have The Arena, we have The Field, we have The Refuge, and we have another one of selections from his letters. We have that, I think it's called Harbor for Hope or something like that. And it's all these selections of letters that he's counseling people who are in suffering. But he was in great suffering and physical pain while he wrote these. And some of them are so beautiful. They're so beautiful. Such a good thing to read. And so St. Ignatius, excuse me, is somebody that his writings, please be familiar with those. So I know that I've recommended a lot of things to read, but obviously you don't have to read these all at once. You know, you have many years to read these things, hopefully. And so the Life of St. Anthony, definitely. Life of St. Anthony, everybody should read. That's one you could go read tonight and finish half of it easily. You know, who else did we talk about?
We can go through it all again with all my pages here. Okay, so we did St. Anthony, the Life of St. Anthony. It's definitely a must read, okay? After St. Anthony, we talked about St. John Climacus, The Ladder of Divine Ascent. Again, everyone should have it. It's not a book that you necessarily want to read all the way through, but you should have it and reference it every now and then. Okay. St. Paisios Velichkovsky didn't really write a lot, so it's not his writings. I just want you to be familiar with his life. St. Nicodemus, the Hagiorite, he's the reason we have the Philokalia. And so the Philokalia, again, I'm not saying that everyone needs to read all the way through the Philokalia, but you should be familiar with what it is and why it's such an important work in Orthodox spirituality. St. Theophon the Recluse, everybody should have the books Path to Salvation and The Spiritual Life and How to Be Attuned to It. Those are ones that I think everyone really should have. St. Seraphim Sarov, everybody should have A Life of St. Seraphim. Believe me, you'll find how worth it is. And then the Optina Elders, it'd be good to be familiar with them. At least read that article. And if you want to read about one of them, again, St. Ambrose is the one I would suggest. And finally, St. Ignatius Brancheninov. You know that we've already told you have to read The Field. And everyone has to read The Field. The Field is great. It'll make you want to read the rest of his writings. Okay, so these are all these great figures. So again, going back to what we started with. If the faith is real, then it should make people who speak and live and act and pray and breathe and work wonders like the apostles. And I've just told you about 7, kind of 8 of them. In fact, if we kill 14 of the Optina elders, I told you about more, 20 of them. So these are figures who are powerhouses of the spiritual life, and we have a lot to learn from them. And so the main thing isn't to read them so that we can check off a book and say I read it. The main thing is to read them in order to make their life our life as much as possible. And so we wean little lessons here and there. What you don't understand, leave. What you do understand, take and live it as much as you possibly can. So next week is just, it continues. I hope you are enjoying or have enjoyed today, because I told you I was so eager to get to this one, because this is the culmination of everything we've talked about. This is what the faith does to people. And we look at these figures and we go, oh, that's so beyond me. It's not. It's not so beyond you. And I'm going to prove that to you next week. Next week, I'm going to prove it to you. We're going to talk about more of these great figures, and you're going to go, okay, monk, 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 monk. Next week, we're going to talk about St. John of... I may talk about St. John of Kronstadt. I have a lot here, and I cut down this list, but St. John of Kronstadt, I wanted to include him today, but we weren't going to have time. St. Nectarios of Aegina, you need to know about him. St. Siloam the Athenite and his disciple, St. Sophronia of Essex.
who died in 1993, St. John of San Francisco, who will also lead me to talk a little bit about Father Seraphim Rose, you should know about, St. Joseph the Hesychast and his whole brotherhood, which led to Elder Ephrem of Arizona. We'll talk about St. Paisios of Mount Athos, a different St. Paisios than Velichakovsky, St. Porphyrios, Elder Cleopa of Romania, and then, after all these, besides St. John of Kronstadt, after all these monks, I'm going to tell you about Matushka, who's the priest wife, Olga of Alaska, who is not yet glorified. But when I tell you about her, you're going to be really astounded. What an incredible life. These types of lives, it doesn't matter if they're monastic. It doesn't matter if they're clergy and you're not clergy. None of this matters. It doesn't matter if they're Russian and you're American. It doesn't matter if they lived hundreds of years ago and you didn't. These lives live a common spiritual life of grace. And I'm telling you, it's available to you. It's available. I can tell you plenty of stories of laymen I know who have had great experiences in the faith because they followed these as best they possibly could. In fact, one of my daughters, Juliana, is named after one of these women who was married and had children. But she learned to take the asceticism and live it as best she could and to feed the poor, and her relics are incorrupt to this very day. St. Philothea, my other daughter, is named after a girl who was killed by her father at the age of 14, and her relics are incorrupt to this day. So this life is available to you, and I want you to understand that. And how do we obtain this life? Live the life of the church. It's all right here in front of you. Make this your life as much as possible. So I get hopped up on this one. I love this. I've never done the catechism like this before. I've never done this where I spend a couple weeks just talking about saints. So I've been really looking forward to it, but you can imagine it takes a lot of work to do this. It's fun work, though. I like this work. So next week is going to be really, really, really great, I hope. So hopefully you've enjoyed this. Any questions before we finish up? I know this is kind of an odd one to ask questions about, but
yeah,
let's go for it. Here.
Can you remind me what year St. Anthony was born?
St. Anthony was born in two... Who hasn't memorized my talk? Come on.
251.
F. Fail. I was off too.
Can you tell me what volume of the Philadelphia
Velichakovsky?
Yeah. What volume he wrote?
No, he didn't write a volume of the Philokalia. He translated the Philokalia.
Oh, okay.
But he has another series that Father Seraphim Rose did that's called the Little Russian Philokalia.
Yes.
So it's not the Philokalia as that Saint Nicodemus did. It's just a book of wisdom from Russian elders and saints. And St. Paisios has, I forget what volume, I think it's volume 3 or something like that, but if you just look up Little Russian Philokalia and St. Paisios, you'll find it. It's a very thin volume.
I've got volume 5.
It's a great series, by the way. There's one on St. Seraphim Straw of St. Hermann of Alaska, St. Theodore of Sinaksar, and one other who I'm forgetting, but it's a great series to have. But that's a separate thing from the Philokalia.
Okay. Yeah.
Okay. Yes?
It seems like 19th century Russia is just full of all these great spiritual people. Is there some book you would recommend that's just sort of a general overview of the spirit, what the spiritual life was like during that period before the revolution? My thesis.
Yeah, this is the question was, is there a single volume to really talk about the 19th century Russia's spiritual tradition? And Robert is actually the Russian expert here. I'm not. This is actually his area, literally his area of expertise. And so is there a volume you'd recommend? Because most of the volumes that I know of are not translated into English yet.
Yeah,
they're mostly in Russian. And there's a lot of great Russian ones that I see referenced all the time in footnotes, but they're not translated yet. So I don't know if there's anything.
There's really so little that's translated, which is terrible. There's a great history of the Russian Orthodox Church. It's called A Long Walk to Church.
It's a very famous book, A Long Walk to Church,
yeah,
about the
Russian
Church. And it's
by the person who would have to walk for something crazy, like 115 miles to the nearest church.
But that's in Russian?
No, that's in English.
Oh, yeah, that one's in English.
I had to pick one thing in English. Oh, it'd be bad.
Okay.
But like, it's so hard. You have to like pick and choose between a bunch of little things.
This is why I recommended that article on the Optina Elders, because I've never found one book to really cover this all. And I read through this article this week, and I want to read it again, because I read it quickly because I had so much to do. I want to read it really slowly this week because it is such a beautiful article, and it will give you at least a sense of some of this. So.
An article from where?
It's the one that I mentioned on St. Paisios, the Arizona Monastery's website. It's going to be linked on the resources of the catechumen class. So.
So, are you going to translate all the Russian history books for us, Robert?
I'm actually working on a translation of St. Maximus the Greek that's unpublished in English.
Oh,
so from Russian.
Yeah, Robert gets obediences that no one else gets. None of you will I look to and say, translate this. But Robert, I was like, translate this. If you want to save your soul, translate this work. All right, thank you all so much. Next week is going to be a big Saturday. Big Saturday. We're going to have baptisms, right? Hornock family, the Pendergrass family, and Alex back there. And so we're going to have a beautiful baptismal liturgy in the morning. So everyone, please come to that. And if you want to just hang out at church all day long, hang out at church. Otherwise, you know, go get something to eat, come back, and then we'll have the final of the catechism classes. Again, I hope you've been enjoying this, because as I said to you at the beginning, I'm doing this catechism very differently than I've done it in the past. And I think this one just feels more alive. It doesn't feel as academic. It doesn't feel as heady. You know, the whole point is to culminate in these figures. And I mean, literally, you know me, good German, I don't weep. I wept reading some of these lives again. It's been a while since I've read some of them. And I'd forgotten, you know, it's like a forgotten love. And you read some of these things and you go, oh my goodness, like this was such an important figure in my life, and I need to go back and kind of reacquaint myself. And so again, hopefully this has inspired you to go do some more reading and really venerate these saints. So God bless and keep you. See you upstairs for Vespers.